though politically some things have changed. But of course, economically, a lot of things still, unfortunately, remain partially the same. So does that understanding, I want to talk about it, what you have learned that you can also help the Palestinian people with in dealing with their struggle. I mean, what would you say to them if you had a forum for the Palestinians as far as continuing their struggle and what to look at and what to do and how to actually remove their oppressors? I mean, what would you say?
Look, you know, the first and foremost, struggles, as the people of Iran themselves will know, struggles are hard. They are long, toiling, projects to undertake. And so their own struggle that has gone on for more than 74 years, I mean, sorry, for more than 70 years, they should not be discouraged. Our struggle took more than 300 years. So struggles are long and hard. They are difficult, they are painful, but ultimately they must take from our example that indeed struggles for self-determination are morally just, they are right, they always prevail. I think that's a first. The second one is, the unity remains a central issue in any struggle. And so continuing to build that unity amongst the Palestinian people, in the face of this brutal and ever increasingly barbaric and monstrous attack by the Zionist state should not in any way, detract from the efforts or shift the focus from the need for building a durable unity amongst the Palestinian people. And then the third one, of course, is also for the Palestinian people to think ahead, post-apartheid Israel order where the Palestinian people will be determining their own future. And so it is important that they must be clear, firstly, to know in terms of what it is exactly that they are going to do, but secondly, also to avoid the pitfalls, that we, for instance, South Africans have become trapped in, because they don't have to go through those experiences themselves.
Well, looking at, because at one point, you talked about a 300-year struggle, but then at one point, public opinion, or if we look at global opinion and how it started to change and more mass support came from, well, throughout the world for the anti-apartheid effort in South Africa. Looking at today and the Palestinian situation, we see movements here and there. We see certain movements that have become more and more effective. But what do you think it's going to take, one, to break this type of media censorship that we're seeing that can actually inform the people of the world of the reality on the ground there?
Look, I mean, once more from our own experience, we've never had the support of Western governments to start with. Ours was an effort by the people of our country and the leadership of the liberation movement to slowly build popular support, and started, and our leadership and others who were in exile started embedding themselves in social and political movements abroad. In the UK, they were involved in student struggles there. They became involved in the anti-war and anti-nuclear movement. And so they embedded themselves in all aspects of political and social life in the countries in which they were exiled. And so South Africa, the South African issue, then slowly became part, of the mainstream political discourse in Western countries. You will recall, President Mandela, the now venerated President Mandela, was declared officially a terrorist by countries like the US and UK. Indeed, President Mandela was only removed from the list of prohibited people as a terrorist from the US terrorist list only about 3-4 years after he had already vacated the office of President of the Republic of South Africa. So from our experience, that is what we had to do It was only much later, you know, when there was momentum from trade unions, from political organizations and so on, you know, artists and everybody else really, that the governments of these countries were forced to the table eventually to support, to act at least, even if it was tokenism at the time, but to accept, you know, as fait accompli.
Okay, I think I lost you, Tshisekedi? Okay, I think I've lost that connection with Tshisekedi. You're looking now at those images coming from, again, various cities throughout Iran where people have turned out unbelievably, of course, once again, to show their support. I mean, we talked earlier, I've talked to a lot of guests today, and we're talking about first and foremost about Imam Khomeini and making that decision, deciding that this is a priority for the Islamic Republic of Iran. But after that, it has been the people themselves of Iran who have continued to be on the scene. There's no one making anyone go out there on these days of fasting, long days of fasting, but the people who have that sense of solidarity with the oppressed all over the world. And, of course, with Palestine, that it is a priority in many ways because of what has taken place in Palestine. And, of course, now throughout this month of this holy month of Ramadan, there have been just unbelievable images coming from that region and seeing Palestinian worshipers being attacked during this holy month of Ramadan in Masjid al-Aqsa is something really unbearable for the people of Iran to see. And definitely enhance the people's will to go out during these fasting days against to support the people of Palestine and to say that you're not alone. And that has been the main message, actually, of revolutionary Iran since 1979. I believe that I have Mohsen Abbas with me. Are you with me?
Yes, I am, Marzia.
Okay, out of Islamabad. Okay, great to see you. So let's talk about this. You know, we often talk about sacrifices that have to be made. But when we look at Iran and taking the stand that it did in 1979, and of course, the first Palestinian embassy in the world was opened here shortly after the victory of the revolution, that Iran from day one basically has made Palestine one of its priorities, one of its main priorities. And Iran has paid a price, of course, for that. But at the other hand, we see that the resistance is growing stronger and stronger every day. But let's talk about that, that a revolutionary government with all of the problems that it have itself, I mean, what does that say that at the same time they are able or it's able to prioritize other people or other nations besides themselves?
Well, I think, first of all, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran at its core has a fundamentally different set of values and principles based on a moral and ethical code, which is Islamic. And I think that of all the Muslim nations in the world, only the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a genuine stand in terms of helping Palestinians, not only with aid of a kind of humanitarian kind, but they've also been supportive in a military sense. And I don't think there's any hiding this in reality. And the fact of the matter is that no imperialist power, no colonialist power has ever given up a plot of land that it's occupied or it's invaded without being resisted by all means. And I think that Palestinians lacked one thing. They've always had the heart and they've always had the desire for return. They've always had the burning, if you like, love for their land, their nation. But what they lacked was the means. And of course, the Arab governments and most of the Muslim world, and of course, the so-called international community, which usually means America and Britain, the ones who are actually causing most of the problems and keeping Israel functioning as the kind of apartheid regime that it is, have all failed the Palestinians. They've not given them the kind of support that was really truly necessary for them to be able to stand with dignity. So what we've had is grassroots, ground-up sort of intifadas. We've had individuals sacrificing themselves. We had a phase where Yasser Arafat was, began to hijack planes as well. You know, so there was all this kind of range of phases which the Palestinians had gone through. But what's happened now is actually there is a sea change on the ground amongst the Palestinians and a confidence that is growing based on the support primarily of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Let's not beat around the bush, and the resistance axis itself. Without that support, I really rather think that even the Palestinian resistance itself would have floundered by now, because it had so many divisions and was infiltrated so badly by Mossad, infiltrated by Western powers and the Zio-Arabian leaders in that region, that had the resistance not stepped in and really stepped up when it was necessary, what we would have seen is the Palestinians completely, under the cosh in terms of the whole of the West Bank even taken over. Okay. So I think Iran has been absolutely fundamental in really keeping the Palestinian cause alive, single-handedly.
All right. Well, crossing back to Johannesburg and to Setso, I want to look at, we see a lot of oppressed people and actually continuing that solidarity with the Palestinian people, because it's really interesting, because we're seeing, for example, in Nigeria, a very strong pro-Palestinian movement takes place, and actually even, unfortunately, for the last several years on this day, Quds Day, we have seen at least a few people being killed as they demonstrate in support of the Palestinian cause. I want to talk about that part. Is it something natural for other oppressed people to support the Palestinian cause? But what makes it an exception is when they are willing to pay a price for others. I want to talk about that aspect and your assessment of that. Tesetso, can you hear me? Okay, I think I've lost him again, unfortunately. So I'll pose that same question, throw it back to Said Mohsen Abbas about that natural alliance. You know, we're seeing not only, for example, in Nigeria, but we'll probably see a large demonstration in Yemen and other places. What about that even though that they are oppressed themselves, that people are willing to go out for the cause of Palestine? Your assessment.
Absolutely. I mean, I think who can empathize with the oppressed more than those who are oppressed? Absolutely logical and rational to do that. And the Yemenis, even the Irish, I would say, quite often I find when I speak to the Irish who suffered under British, colonialism, and still do, arguably, you know, they're still an occupied part of Ireland. And those people often are the most passionate in terms of their defense of Palestinian rights, because they know what it's like. And I think that that's a natural gravitation towards a, you know, fellow oppressed, which is there. But I think that amongst the mainstream, certainly amongst the West, there is still a lot of ambivalence and a kind of moral relativism, which is another human trait. For those who are living easy lives, they find it seems very easy to pick and choose who they want to empathize with. And you see that in most recent examples of the Ukraine. So it's not a hidden fact now that we've seen the way the Western media and the way the Western public has reacted to the invasion of Ukraine. And if we were to compare that to the invasion of Palestine and the occupation over 70 years of Palestine, you see quite clearly that there's a moral relativism, and somehow there seems to be a sort of a subliminal racism, perhaps even, you know, of course, there's an Islamophobia as well. And these are things which the West needs to really, the Western society and the people need to look inside their own, if you like, in their own consciences, and ignite what is true humanity and true justice, which is that you should be equal for all, and you should fight for all oppressed. And Imam Khomeini has clearly laid the seeds, a very visionary seed in the Al-Quds Day, and just generally the focus on the oppressed of Palestine. I mean, they were oppressed in Kashmir, we know they were oppressed in Yemen, they were oppressed during Imam Khomeini's time, many, many other nations. But why Palestine? Well, because it's where the root cause of what most of the global oppression occurs, because the global money mafias that run the show have invested in Israel. Their foundation was laid by the Rothschilds, for instance, and that's a well-known fact. It's not any kind of conspiracy theory. We know that the Western powers that are also manipulated and work for those same money mafias are the ones who are paying in $3 billion a year in America, for instance. Mm-hmm. That's just what we know in terms of arming it to the teeth and making sure that Israel survives on a life support machine, which is tagged to the American economy. The American people, meanwhile, of course, get very little moral sympathy from their own governments because so many people are suffering from poverty there.
Stay with me, Seyed Mohsen. Let me cross over. Let's take a look at... we've talked to some of the leadership there in Gaza, some of the revolutionary leaders. Let's take a look at some of their comments and what they have to say.
يوم القدس العالمي نوجه تحية كل التحية إلى الجمهورية الإسلامية في إيران والتي أكد إمامها الراحل الخميني على هذا اليوم تذكيرا لأجيال المسلمين بواجبهم اتجاه القدس وتحقيقا للوحدة الإسلامية. في يوم القدس العالمي نوجه التحية كذلك إلى شعبنا الفلسطيني المرابطين في المسجد الأقصى والقدس المدافعين عن كرامة الأمة. في يوم القدس العالمي نحن أقرب إلى تحقيق حلم أبناء شعبنا والأمة بتحرير القدس والأقصى والأسرى بإذن الله تعالى. في يوم القدس العالمي يجب أن تتضافر كل جهود الأمة العربية والإسلامية لتحقيق الوحدة الإسلامية ولأجل السعي اتجاه دعم أهلنا المقدسي.
قضیه فلسطین از یادان نخواهد رفت و شهر مقدس بیت المقدس پایتخت فلسطین باقی خواهد ماند و قبله اول مسلمان ها برای مسلمان ها باقی خواهد ماند.
The issue of occupied Palestine will never be forgotten. The holy city of Beit al-Muqaddas will remain forever the capital of Palestine. And the first Qibla of Muslims will always be there for Muslims. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're continuing with our live coverage of the International Quds Day events and rallies here in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we've received quite a few, actually, emails from our listeners around the world. Many emails also from our listeners here in Tehran, the Iranian capital. I'm going to read out a few of these. I'm going to read out one from one of our listeners in Pennsylvania, United States. It's Muhammad Khaku. Muhammad Khaku from Pennsylvania, United States. He says, in my opinion, about 1 million messages and emails have to be sent to newspapers and mass media around the world to highlight the occupation of Palestine. I participate in World Quds Day rallies so that I can say I tried to inform the Muslim Ummah of the atrocities of the Zionist regime in Palestine. attending such rallies, writing letters to editors and imams delivering sermons on the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan scared the reactionary pro-Israel Arab rulers and their Western Zionist masters. Al-Quds is at the very heart of Islam and the Muslim Ummah. Its status at any given time reflects the general health of the entire body of Muslims. Muslims are like one body. If one limb hurts, then the whole body hurts. And so does the Muslim Ummah feel the pain with injustice to the Palestinians. Ramadan must be seen primarily as the month of struggle and jihad. It becomes incumbent upon all Muslims to share the pain and suffering, just like one body, in the face of injustice.
And we've received an email from Chris Jensen from Belgium. He's one of our regular listeners. Chris Jensen says, Al-Quds Day is a very important day for me as this day represents two highly important symbolic issues. Al-Quds regarded from its religious angle and Al-Quds regarded from its political angle. Al-Quds is historically a unique place for humanity because its significance to the three monotheistic Abrahamic religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. This holy place of worship where the entire humanity adhering to one of the monotheistic religions meets each other in full solidarity and unity has for years been desecrated by the brutal occupying Zionist expansionist political movement, which has no place in true Judaism. It would be a grave mistake to regard Zionism as a representative of true Judaism. The Zionist occupation of the land of Palestine with Al-Quds at his heart makes the place also a symbol for everyone in each corner of the world who is resisting injustice and imperialism. Even for less religious people, Palestine, Al-Quds, and the Palestinian people are the symbols of resistance against the injustice imposed on the Palestinian people, while also abstracting this symbolism from its place and time. Al-Quds is a symbol of the fight against injustice and tyranny all over the world. The struggle for Al-Quds is the struggle for freedom, justice, and sincere religious values. For every peace-loving human in the world, regardless of time and place. So this was an email from Chris Jensen from Belgium, one of our regular listeners. After a short break, we go live to Press TV headquarters to have the comments of Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator.
A project which they refused to let go of, and it has become the nerve center, not only for spreading conflict and terror and violence across the Middle East in order to keep the Arabs divided and keep the people of that region divided enough for the resource pillaging and the looting and the plunder to continue, but they've also become a problem insofar as Israel and Tel Aviv are also one of the nerve centers of the cyber and technological industries. And what you've got is this this kind of growth in the amount of internet traffic and the control of most of the global internet and cyber services, actually, which a lot of people don't know, but is being focused very much in Israel. And they're, in fact, building in the Sinai an entire city, which is going to expand this process of cyber warfare, cyber control, and cyber activities for the control of the world. So there's an important role there that Israel is being utilized for as well. Add to this, of course, that they, you know, as an Anglo-Zionist empire, it needs a global reach and it needs a policeman. Of course, these are just some of those duties which Israel is carrying out. And ideologically, of course, once you put in a force like this, which then helps to sponsor sectarianism amongst Muslims, which is very much what Mossad has been up to across the region, it's willing to assassinate people. It's done that to Iranian nuclear scientists, for instance, and many, many others to disrupt the technological advancement of the what they consider to be their subjects in that region. And they've also, of course, unleashed many proxy wars. Saddam's war on Iran was something very much which the Anglo-Zionist Empire, along with Israel, supported in a huge way. They've done this in Iraq, then they've done this in Syria, and most embarrassingly of all, and most viciously of all, they've done this most recently with ISIS and with Daesh, who have been supported with medicine, supported with military training, with arms supplies, and they've been very much at the heart of being one of the prime groups which has spread the terrorism across that region. I mean, that's just a number of the issues which makes Israel absolutely the center point of if you like, problems and conflicts, and why Al-Quds Day is far more important than just liberation for Palestinians as a land issue. It actually affects the liberation and the freedom of all of the people of that region, and I would say possibly all of the people around the globe, because the exceptionalism of Israel that you see, even the likes of Russia perhaps participating in to some extent or a great extent, the Chinese do it as well. You know, everybody in the global superpower circuit doesn't seem to want to touch them. The only force that has stood vehemently and openly and stridently against them has been the Imam Khomeini, Imam Khamenei-led resistance axis. And it is there that we have to see the real honesty and integrity of a force that wants to bring in liberation, wants to bring true, independence and true sovereignty, not only for the people of Palestine, but for the entire region. And I'll say this openly again, it's Israel which prevents that true liberation, along with its Anglo-Zionist partners and its Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the only Islamic state, Muslim state, which truly stands by Palestinians and for the oppressed. This has been proven over 40 years, time and time again.
Well, when we look at the situation right now, I mean, if we go back from the beginning and when this entity was created, the Zionist entity, and now we see how Palestinians are reacting and responding, your perspective, there seems to be a newfound confidence and almost a type of perspective that the Palestinians feel that they're getting closer and closer to victory. We see the strength of the resistance that's increasing, it appears, on a daily basis. I mean, your take on all of that, the difference from before, whether we're looking at 20, 30 years ago, and now, today, 2022, the resistance and Palestine.
I think the game changer was the right of return march. That was genius in terms of a strategy for reminding Palestinians themselves that they have an inexorable right to the land of Palestine, and nobody can take that away from them. Previously, what had happened is the sellout elements within the Palestinian movement, Abbas and those who run, for instance, the West Bank, had lured Palestinian people and confused them into thinking a two-state solution, for instance, was an option and that the Israelis were sincere about it. That collapsed. You saw that ultimately collapse in a sort of full and total way with Trump unleashing all his deal of the centuries and that kind of nonsense. And then the handing over of Jerusalem increasingly as a capital and the move towards turning Israel into a Jewish fundamentalist state, essentially, and a greater binding down of an apartheid situation for those who actually...
Just hold your thoughts. We're going to continue just a few seconds. I just want to let our viewers know what they're looking at is actually Kashmir there, Kashmir region. And, of course, we know that Kashmir has been under a lot of stress and much oppression that they have seen recently and crackdowns, of course, on the Indian control part of Kashmir. Today you're seeing there... people turning out and demonstrating there in support of the Palestinian cause. Go ahead, Said Mohsen. Sorry, I just wanted to let the viewers know what they're looking at.
Just in passing, I'll mention that what's happening in Kashmir, the template has been borrowed also from Israel. So you can see that what Israel has been doing in terms of its policies of taking out settlements in and occupying land which was even the minimum land that was left to Palestinians, the ethnic cleansing essentially of in vast regions, the iron boot kind of regime of like military pressure on the Palestinian people. That has become a model, Marzia, and that model is now being implemented in Kashmir on a daily basis. They have been advising, these same Israeli military fellows and their Mossad agents have got a strong link with the Indian establishment, and they've now started implementing the same policies of land grabs and taking away the rights of Kashmiris, just for instance, the dissolution of an old law which didn't allow non-Kashmiris to come in and purchase land, for instance, was done away with. And now what you find is this kind of invasion of or the open doors for Hindutva neo-Nazis, effectively, or neo-fascists, rather, who are now beginning to move into Kashmir. And that is a policy which mirrors the annexation of remaining Palestinian land by Jewish settlers, which is informally and under the sort of carpet being sanctioned by the government, but they put it down to settlers. But it's in fact the Israeli government policy. So you can see that a bad regime like Israel is becomes not just something which is a problem in Palestine, but it becomes a template which becomes possible to use elsewhere. I mean, Ukrainian neo-fascists have been doing this. In Europe, you're finding that kind of that racism and that fascism being normalized as well. So I would say that when you let a nation like an illegitimate nation like Israel get away with all that it has, it's a cancer, and it's a template of a cancer which will spread everywhere, a virus that you can't stop. And coming back to, you know, Israel itself and its own situation, the fact of the matter is they got away with murder, literally, for 70 years plus. The problem for them now is that they face a real resistance. And the Palestinians internally, as I was saying before before the video in Kashmir, they essentially had been confused by the Arabs who were promising, the Zayed Arabs, who were promising them money, land, promising them a settlement, which they never delivered, first of all. But it was all a distraction. And some of the Palestinian leadership, it's undeniable that they actually sided with those folk and actually were negative towards the real resistance. That, I think, has changed on the ground. With the new leadership of the Palestinian liberation, you find that there is a stronger commitment to real resistance. Now, you can't liberate a land unless you yourself are willing to go all the way for your land and sacrifice your life, your family, your everything. That's the way liberation works against an oppressor like Israel. There's going to be no other way. And of course, you can say to them, yes, we want a one man, one vote, which Ayatollah Khamenei has been the leader in terms of promoting the idea that those with a legacy heritage connection to Palestine, the diaspora, should all be allowed back to Palestine, should all be allowed to vote, and a real democratic system should be established in which those people are allowed to actually vote for what Palestine should be. And that, of course, is something the Israelis, the current Israeli regime, will never even consider.
Okay.
They won't allow that
to happen. And on that note, I am so sorry to interrupt. You said Mohsen Abbas, but we are out of time. I appreciate you being with us out of Islamabad. And I appreciate you viewers who stayed with us all these hours for our rolling coverage here at Press TV on this, the International Day of Quds. I'm Marzia Hashemi. It's been a pleasure being with you. I'm going to leave from now, but my good colleague, Omid, will be joining and bringing you all the news in just a few minutes. Thanks so much for staying with us right here at Press TV.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, you've just heard our live coverage of the International Quds Day events, rallies and marches here in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And just the latest news, at least 42 Palestinians have been injured after Israeli troops raided the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque today in the city of Al-Quds. Israeli troops fired tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, 42 people injured. Thanks for being with us throughout this live event. And it just remains for me, Mehran Darakhshande, to say goodbye.
Many thanks for being with us.
And we now go back to our live, regular programming here on Arabi English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. What you just heard was our special coverage. We now return to our normal course of programs.
Midstream.
The City of Peace. The city of prophets and messengers for Christians and Muslims. It is the Honorable Al-Quds, the first of the two Qiblas where the children of Zion tried a lot to obliterate its identity through occupation and vandalism. On International Al-Quds Day, the world once again bears witness to our covenant to stand in solidarity with Palestine until full liberation. The Quds Day Project, announced by Imam Ruhullah Khomeini in the first year of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, established a culture revival project with distinction and popular mobilization to create vigilance in the conscience of the nation. Perhaps choosing the last Friday of the month of Ramadan, calling it Al-Quds Day, in itself represents the culture of confronting normalization with the occupation for various considerations. It is impossible for a person to live with occupation. Therefore, it is impossible to coexist and normalize with the usurping entity. This is the main value in the late Imam's thought on the issue of Al-Quds. Imam Khomeini viewed the issue from an existential point of view, that is, as a threat to the entire Islamic presence, and not only targeting an Arab region or land, but rather a colonial, arrogant, and Western imperialist presence in the depth and heart of the Islamic and Arab world, and the difference between the two views is massive. Hence, the positions of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini and the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, confirm that the Zionist entity is the main factor in triggering conflicts and threatening the stability of the region. Israel represents the front line of Western colonialism in the Islamic world. This culture, whose goal from the beginning was to break up the Islamic identity of this region and the identity of Arab Palestine in general, has become indistinct today in Arab cultures, up to a point where normalization became a regular matter and a personal choice. This is one of the most dangerous issues we are dealing with today, especially as we approach International Al-Quds Day. Why? Because the issue of Judaization has become an automatic result of the culture of normalization that gives confidence to an occupying and usurping entity to expropriate land that does not belong to it, to expel its people from their homes, and to settle in their houses and country. Decades later, this land becomes the land of Zion, where maps and history books forget its original identity. The announcement of International Al-Quds Day is at the heart of the culture of resistance and confrontation in the face of normalization and occupation. Simply to say that Al-Quds will not be lost, rather it will remain with its Palestinian people who represent the pole of truth in the struggle between the forces of right and wrong. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Imam Khomeini, may Allah's mercy and blessings be upon him, was aware of the nature of the conflict with the Zionist enemy and deeply aware of the dimensions of the battle with this cancerous entity when he focused his intelligence and his foresight. Since the first moment of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, on the core of the Palestinian cause and its main axis, which is Al-Quds al-Sharif. The holy city, which for us does not mean only the earth, the stone, and the trees, but rather the spirit of a nation, the conscience and the honor of every free Muslim and Christian and every believer, rather every free human being, in whose veins the blood of pride, dignity, and faith pulsates. Thanks to Imam Khomeini's will, the issue of Al-Quds and Palestine turned into a meeting point for Muslims, a source of their unity, and a date for their interaction of free peoples with the oppression of the Palestinian people who are subjected to murder and racial liquidation. To discuss this issue with us from London is Robert Carter, producer, journalist, and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Robert. Now, International Al-Quds Day, which is approaching this week, is seen as the legacy of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the leader of the revolution, the late Imam Ruhullah Khomeini, who back in 1979, just shortly after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, declared the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as International Al-Quds Day. How do you think Palestine has benefited from this day, Robert?
Well, I think that Palestinians have benefited immensely from today. First of all, you know, there is the obvious that today is dedicated to offering solidarity to the Palestinians. But in specific, I think that what separates this day from other days of the year, which offers a similar type of solidarity to Palestinians, is that this day has maintained a very brave aspect in regards to the position that it's taken and the fact that it backs one very genuine, uncompromising position that Palestinians and their supporters have taken on the issue. So, for example, many other movements in the West which offer support to Palestine, they have actually compromised on many positions. They're actually scared to say certain things, and we won't platform certain commentators, certain viewpoints which are in support of Palestine because it's too controversial. Things like Palestinian or religious Orthodox Jew, for example, simply want to go back before 1940, before Israel, the concept of the apartheid state even came into existence. That type of viewpoint has been censored and gagged here as well, and it's deemed as too offensive, too outrageous, too controversial, because it goes against Israel completely, even the very concept of the colonialist project at all. And, of course, could stay preserves the platform, that very important and very popular view, which I dare say the majority of Palestinians actually believe and support to this day. So could stay is very important in not just support for the Palestinians, but also pointing the finger at those who are truly responsible and criticizing the racist political ideology of Zionism, which basically you're not allowed to do in mainstream discourse here in the Western world specifically.
Well, Robert, over the two past months, we did see that the Israeli occupation forces have increased their aggression against Palestinians, especially in the occupied Al-Quds, whether with the worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque or with the residents of Jenin camp, or with the worshippers of the church as well. But the Christians also in Al-Quds were being harassed by the occupation forces, and especially also after we saw many operations inside the occupied territories targeting colonial settlers in Tel Aviv or Hedera or Beni Brak. How do you think this year's Al-Quds International Day will be any different from the other years that have passed before it?
Well, it is very different because pressure is mounting on Israel. I think that they've lost the PR campaign. The global awareness for the Palestinian cause is at an all-time high. And I think now more and more people are starting to realize that, look, we can't allow things to continue as they are. Something has to change. And the Palestinian people need justice. They need freedom. And could they, in that day of the year, which basically allows for people to vent their frustration properly, without censorship, without being afraid. And that's why it's so important. And I think that we have to remember that it's not just the Palestinians who are benefiting and look to Quds Day specifically as the day to fight for their cause, but also Orthodox Jewish communities who feel as if they are also being oppressed by Israel. And that it's compromising their religious traditions and beliefs. And also the Christians, Arab Christians, as you mentioned, who are also being oppressed. And this year specifically, we have the overlap of Ramadan for Muslims, but also Easter celebrations for Christians. And on both counts, Israeli regime forces have been oppressing, beating down, and attacking innocent, unarmed worshippers, both Christian, Muslim, and I dare say, religious Jews alike. So could say is a rallying cry, not just for Muslims, not just for Palestinians, but for everyone, Christians, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, everyone to come together and to give them the opportunity to vent their frustration and to offer solidarity, united, without fear, without censorship, basically giving them the right freedom of speech at the very least, because they don't have the right of freedom on their own land right now. So at the very least, we should give them the platform to have their own freedom of speech.
Well, the Western world is preaching to us now constantly, as you may have noticed, Robert, about the Russia-Ukraine war, while completely shunning Palestine. How do you assess the silence of the so-called international community, on top of which is the United Nations silence on such incremental genocide against the native Palestinians? I mean, anyone who has two eyes can see, and if they don't have eyes, they can hear it. And still, it's nothing. It's like zero.
Yes, you're right. It's disgusting double standards from the West. I think that they've lost any resemblance of moral authority on the global issues, especially when you've seen from the coverage of Ukraine that blonde-haired, blue-eyed Europeans simply treated better than Muslims or Arabs or people from the African continent, anyone of a darker complexion. They are basically treated and are considered less human. It's okay if bombs are dropping in Gaza. That's normal. That's acceptable. It's okay if Muslims are being oppressed or Palestinians or Arabs are being subjugated. That's just what they do. You know, they're terrorists at the end of the day. They deserve it. Why should we, break away from the normal narrative that we've been brought up to believe that is an acceptable standard for human beings to live in? But when it happens in Europe, oh my goodness, then there's coverage, 24-hour, major international reaction, and it is a total shambles, total disgrace. It's disgusting, and it's exposed the West in an unprecedented way. Now I think everyone around the world is starting to realize that, no, the West are not a moral authority. They should not be allowed to lecture the rest of the world on what's right and what's wrong. Because clearly, if you're going to judge people on that basis, who's in the wrong? It's the Israeli regime. It's the illegal occupation which has been going on for decades. And it's Western imperialism that is by far responsible for more terrorism, death, destruction, warfare than anyone else, anywhere else in the world, whether it be Russia even, or Muslims, or anyone like that. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, the West has been exposed there, and hopefully these are all steps towards the eventual liberation of Palestine. And as we all know, Iran, as well as many other Muslim countries, all that celebrate Quds Day will be there, ready and waiting to see a free Palestine once again, inshallah.
Well, inshallah, I second your thoughts there. Robert Carter, producer, journalist, and political commentator, thank you for joining us from London to talk about Al-Quds, International Al-Quds Day, and how important it is for the plight of the Palestinians to be heard on this entire globe. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk how International Al-Quds Day is important to face normalization in West Asia.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Al-Quds Day is not a day to celebrate a city in occupied Palestine. It is the last Friday in the holy month of Ramadan, launched by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, to reiterate that the issue of Al-Quds Sharif is the core of the Palestinian cause. It's a day for every free soul to acknowledge that the only just solution for the perpetual conflict between Arabs and the Zionist illegal Israel is the ending of the occupation and the return of the city of Al-Quds Sharif to Palestinian sovereignty as the capital of the state of Palestine. International Al-Quds Day crushes normalization attempts in this following report. The last Friday of Ramadan was announced by late Ayatollah Imam Ruhollah Khomeini as the International Al-Quds Day. The conditions of time and place imply that the future would be for Al-Quds, the city that turned into the main address of the regional resistance. Today we see the intensity of serious action for liberating Al-Quds, which gives all those looking to this day strength, determination, and ability. The future of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is heading towards a historic decisiveness. All indications suggest the historic defeat of the occupation entity. As we approach International Al-Quds Day, it is necessary to push forth the events that shed light on the repercussions of cultural normalization between the Zionist entity and a number of Arab regimes, which began normalization since the Camp David Agreement and then prevented the commemoration of the International Al-Quds Day ceremonies in their countries. Perhaps this day, in this year in particular, will be different from previous years in terms of the moral and spiritual momentum of the free people of the world who have long desired to pray in the first of the two Qiblas and reject the continuous cycles of normalization in order to move towards the goal and the cause to restore the ancient image of the Islamic identity. The occupation believed that the strategic environment in the country was ripe for the implementation of its Judaization plans in Al-Quds, to normalize Arab relations with Israel on the basis of common interests in the region, and to transform hostilities from the Zionist occupation to hostility towards Iran. The path of normalization has succeeded publicly in the countries of the Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and others, and the unofficially announced normalization with Saudi Arabia intensified.
The occupation believed that the resistance axis in the region was suffering crises that did not enable it to respond to its crimes and aggression inside and outside Palestine. The assessment of the Zionist position was not accurate in all its aspects. On the Palestinian side, Al-Quds residents rose up, achieving an important realization as the world watched that Al-Quds will never be submissive to the occupation. In the 1948 occupied lands, legendary lone wolf resistance operations shook the occupation entity to its core and made its illegal colonial settlers fear their lives every time they decide to go outside. The popular uprising in Al-Quds may soon develop into a popular uprising that may extend to the triangle Galilee, Jaffa, and Nazareth, and Israel knows and fears it. This year on International Al-Quds Day, the resistance is waiting, the Palestinian people are getting ready, and the axis of the resistance is getting ready too, in hopes that Al-Quds Day will turn into a day of revolution for all of Palestine and its supporters in the region. Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire and host of the Sunday Wire radio show. Thank you very much for being with us, Patrick, from London. Now, the organization of the celebrations of the International Al-Quds Day this year comes in light of heroic battles led by the Palestinians in the face of the occupation, who showed the world that resistance is really their only viable option against neocolonialism and Zionist aggression. How do you think the Western regimes will react to solidarity rallies and marches in their societies with Palestine this year?
I think there's definitely a shift happening, and it's happening globally, especially in the West. The solidarity with the common cause is becoming much more visible. Especially in the United States and also in Europe after a lull in previous years. And so this is the real big issue. So, you know, a lot of people believe that as time passes, younger generations more and more will come to see the truth and the hypocrisy of the situation in the Holy Land, in Palestine. And with that, maybe a much bigger feeling of common cause among humanity, wherever they are in the world, and solidarity could, of course, follow that international solidarity. So that's certainly something that a lot of people are recognizing is happening in recent years.
Well, Patrick, despite the empire's attempt to rip through the Arab and Islamic world with violence, with wars, and with really just shameful normalization agreements with this entity, yet the Palestinian cause seems every year bigger than the year before it. And International Al-Quds Day seems to be holding new meaning every year in the hearts and minds of the peoples of this region and even beyond the region of West Asia. Now, the empire's plans have failed, but normalization is a reality in many Arab states today. How do you assess the impact of Al-Quds Day on these regimes that have normalized with Israel?
This is an interesting question. We're at a very interesting point in history on this. However, you know, if you look at the normalization that's happened in recent years, this has largely been brokered by the United States. This is a political project. And so because it's a political project in that sense, it may end up being perhaps short-lived. It may fold. It may fold even with the monarchies themselves in the historical sense. One day, and also with its U.S. partners. So by the same token, however, these same monarchies in these Gulf states will eventually have to also normalize their relations with their Arab nationalist neighbors, and that will include mutual respect, cooperation, rather than viewing them as a threat or as a playground for the rich. Look at Yemen, look at Iraq, look at Syria, look at Iran, look at the resilience of Palestine. Massive strides have been made in recent years. This is not the same Middle East that it was 20 years ago. It's much different. And there you can see the future of the region and also the future of the world, too.
Well, but wouldn't what is happening in this part of the world maybe make the Western public open up their eyes that these regimes are normalizing, but their public, the societies inside of these regimes had really no say in it? Doesn't that just shout out undemocratic regimes for the West?
Yes, that might be the case. That might be the case. You know, the sad reality is, you know, the global media cycle in the West, it runs on violent spectacles and convenient political virtue signaling narratives that, unfortunately, in the West means that they have to be in line or aligned with U.S. Security interests or Western foreign policy interests. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, you know, it may be the case that supporting an apartheid regime will become untenable back at home, wherever those countries are in the West. And who knows, even perhaps, maybe not so long in the future, it will be unacceptable to the next generation of Israelis mm-hmm. To maintain an apartheid system like this. So this story is definitely have some interesting turns coming in the future.
Well, Patrick, we have heroic prisoners of Palestine who have been subjected to all forms of abuse and humiliation in the detention centers of the Zionist Israel, which are mostly remembered during International Al-Quds Day every year at the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. However, their situation keeps just getting worse year after year. What do you think will it take for the Palestinian detainees, for their cause, for the cause of this, the plight of the Palestinian detainees, to take maybe global center stage just once and for all?
It's going to be very difficult as things stand right now. You know, what's really going to make things help in that point of view is if some of these Gulf states, who knows, maybe led by Qatar. It seems to take the issue up much more seriously than maybe the other so-called normalized Gulf states. It may take some leadership on that side of the Arab world. But beyond that, we're seeing movements in the Arab world, democratic movements, or just exerting more Arab nationalist interests than before. Who knows, a country like Egypt could become very influential in this respect in the near future. Certainly, Syria has ascended to another level in repelling the 10-year proxy war. Iraq also may have better days ahead of it as well. So things are shifting, things are changing in the region. And with that, economic influence, political influence will come, influence the ability to elevate this issue of Palestinian prisoners, of Palestinian suffering, of the oppression that they're suffering. This will become a reality in the future as these countries rise.
Well, it definitely seems that the future holds a lot of surprises for everyone in West Asia. Hopefully some good surprises for the Palestinian people once and for all, for Gaza to break that siege and for the West Bank to break the occupation along with Al-Quds. I want to thank you very much from London, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire and the host of the Sunday Wire radio show. Thank you very much for your contribution. And thank you. May this Ramadan and every other Ramadan bring blessings to you and your family with serenity and peace for everyone, especially for the Palestinian people. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Representative Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, feared in the aftermath of the 6th of January attack that several far-right members of Congress would incite violence against other lawmakers, identifying several by name as security risks in private conversations with party leaders. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alexander Burns and Jonathan Martin. The piece is titled, McCarthy Feared GOP Lawmakers Put People in Jeopardy After 6th of January. In the United States, Representative Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, feared in the aftermath of the 6th of January attack that several far-right members of Congress would incite violence against other lawmakers, identifying several individuals by name as security risks in private conversations with party leaders. Kevin McCarthy talked to other congressional Republicans about wanting to rein in multiple hardliners who were deeply involved in Donald J. Trump's efforts to contest the 2020 presidential election and undermine the peaceful transfer of power, according to an audio recording obtained by the New York Times. But Kevin McCarthy did not follow through under sterner steps that some Republicans encouraged him to take, opting instead to seek a political accommodation with the most extreme members of the GOP, in the interest of advancing his own career. Kevin McCarthy's remarks represent one of the starkest acknowledgments from a Republican leader that the party's rank-and-file lawmakers played a role in stoking violence on 6th of January 2021 and posed a threat in the days after the Capitol attack. Audio recordings of the comments were obtained in reporting from a forthcoming book, This Will Not Pass, Trump, Biden, and the Battle for America's Future. In the phone call with other Republican leaders on 10th of January 2021, Kevin McCarthy referred chiefly to two representatives, Matt Gaetz of Florida and Mo Brooks of Alabama, as endangering the security of other lawmakers and the Capitol complex. But he and his allies discussed several other representatives who made comments they saw as offensive or dangerous, including Lauren Boebert of Colorado and Barry Moore of Alabama. The country was too crazy, Kevin McCarthy said, for members to be talking and tweeting recklessly at such a volatile moment.